Kristen here. Welcome back to Election Intrigue, the podcast. We are less than a month out from Election Day, so it's getting down to the wire and lots of chances for October surprises. Today, John and I will talk about how the situation in the Middle East still is causing the election turnout to potentially look like it could take a hit, especially for the Harris camp. Then we'll dive into some of John's theories on the election voting betting market. And last but not least, give you some poll figures and some updates on what one piece of the data pie is telling us. And as ever, a plug for our daily flagship newsletter. It's International Intrigue. It comes out every weekday morning. It has little nuggets from all around the world from a geopolitical lens, as well as a main story giving you a deep dive into what's on the front pages in a really approachable light. All right, let's dive right in. Hey, John, how's it going?
Good, as always, Kristen. It's that time where we record our election intrigue. So I'm actually great because it's that time of the week.
Exactly. And it's October, which means we're just about in that like kill week zone of under a month.
I know. And not to make banal small talk, but I'm in Boston and autumn, fall has just hit here and I'm in a good mood. It's a good time to be up in Boston.
Well, it's a beautiful day in DC. I actually biked today and to downtown and then showed up sweating, which I was not expecting my sweater. So we have summer in the midday for probably another week.
Enjoy it before it gets cold.
Exactly.
And before the election is all over and we don't have anything to talk about every week.
I know. Before the doom and gloom. Well, actually really before the chaos of the next few weeks. So yeah.
Is the doom and gloom, are you talking about the election or?
Mm-hmm. The doom and gloom of the weeks before when it's just like, dun, dun, dun. Everything that comes out is like that sound on a piano and it's like, crazy.
Yeah, seriously. Well, starting us off on that somewhat ominous note, let's talk about, the Middle East. I know that's as appealing to talk about as drawing blood. It can be pretty tiring to kind of constantly read about the death and destruction and the horrible stuff going on over there. But it is the foreign policy story dominating the U.S. election.
Yeah.
And probably the world's news, but certainly the U.S. election. So why don't you talk us through what happened this week?
Yes. So, well, first of all, this week, a smash Washington hit came out that told us that Joe Biden has a full array of profanities that he's happy to use.
Which you're talking about Bob Woodward's new book, right?
Yes. Bob Woodward came out with the book War, which delves into what I'm going to go into with the Middle East. Yeah. So this week, Israel Defense Minister Yoav Gallant was supposed to leave for Washington and meet with the Pentagon on Tuesday. And just a few hours before he was set to take off, Netanyahu paused Gallant's trip and basically was like, you can't go, you're not going. And reporting in Israeli media emerged that that Netanyahu wanted to speak with Biden before Gallant went and spoke with the defense counterparts, which ended up happening on Wednesday. So Wednesday morning, Biden and Netanyahu spoke on the phone. And according to the White House press poll, Harris also joined the call. Presumably, they talked about retaliation efforts. And the reason why I brought up the book is essentially in the media flurry that's come out with Bob Woodward's book, he says that at times, Biden has grown very frustrated with Netanyahu and said, what's your strategy and other things that
I think
repeat.
That's a really – can I say that? I think that's a really interesting quote. So this is obviously – you're talking about Bob Woodward, the kind of legendary journalist who published a new book this week with some interesting quotes from a Trump aide and from Biden aides. Side note, he seems to be the only kind of serious journalist or serious author that gets to – use one off-the-record source and publish it as fact and have everyone take it as fact. Most books go through a pretty highly rigorous kind of fact-checking process where I don't imagine editors of major publishing houses would accept an aide off-the-record spoke to me and you just have to trust me. But I guess such is his reputation in DC that he gets to do that. But anyway, yeah, so this book it quotes an aide that we don't know who it is saying Biden got very frustrated with Netanyahu on calls and said, what's your strategy, man, in relation to Gaza? And now why I think that's interesting is because that's the question a lot of us have been asking. And I've seen a lot of pretty senior analysts say, sure, Israel is racking up the tactical victories, but they're not winning the strategic war, which is public opinion, changing the Middle East for the better. So I thought that was an interesting insight.
Yeah, I agree. I also, what frustrates me a little bit about that quote getting so much airtime is over the past few months, the media has gobbled up and written, oh, a senior White House source tells us that Biden's actually really pissed at Netanyahu. And it's like, but at the same time, they're unlocking still billions of aid or billions of weaponry to Israel and sending it out. So I just, you know, I understand you can be frustrated. You could also, but it feels like the actions don't necessarily align with that. And that's where I think in some ways the media gets dubbed a little bit because you can direct your comms people to push out that we're quite upset with Netanyahu, but why, you know, in some ways it doesn't feel like there's this questioning around, okay, well then how come the action isn't matching the wording? But that's long.
Do we have any insight on why Netanyahu canceled Gallant's trip to Washington? He was supposed to meet with Lloyd Austin to talk, I think, generally transactional things, right? Like continued support, operations, what's going on in Lebanon about Hezbollah. But it presumably was a political level decision to cancel his trip. Do you think?
Yeah, I think it was a political level decision. I also just believe that, you know, likely they want to get their understanding of what exactly a retaliation will look like. And that's going to come from all the way high up. It is a little bit curious as like, but why it was, I mean, here's also to say it wasn't canceled. Technically it's been delayed.
Postponed,
there isn't further details of when it's going to happen. I think, you know, if he ends up coming later this week and he touches down Washington on Thursday or Friday, then it's like, okay, sure. Netanyahu just wanted to talk to Biden first. And that could be believable, but I mean, I think that's probably in some, that's a piece of the pie for sure. The whole pie though is unclear.
Do we have a readout on the conversation between Biden and Netanyahu yet? We don't, right?
Not that I checked, but it should come out. I mean, we're talking at 3 p.m. It should be out. It should have either been out in the last, you know, 15 minutes or out very soon this afternoon. They had said in the readout that it would come out soon, and that was around noon.
Yeah, look, I'm struggling to put all of this together. I really am. And you know, a good analysis would tell you that when you're not sure, don't pretend that you are sure. And I got asked in a media appearance earlier this week whether it was a smart strategy for the Biden administration to continually say that a ceasefire is close or a ceasefire is around the corner, like they've been doing for most of 2024. And that's downstream of this idea of like, oh, we're upset with Netanyahu. I guess the broader question is what's behind the Biden strategy of going public with their thinking and their interactions with the Israeli administration? And I honestly don't know what the answer is, because I think by now it's fairly clear that Netanyahu doesn't listen to Biden. He's making his own decisions. He feels pretty good that, as you note, he has wedged the Americans on providing support to Israel. I think this is not a conspiracy theory. This is wild speculation on my behalf, but I think the timing of the Netanyahu response in terms of Gaza and Lebanon is very clearly influenced by the US election. I think Netanyahu in 2023 or 2022 or next year, 2025, regardless of who's elected president, his reaction would have been very different, because I think he knew that this year was a unique opportunity to make sure that no president, no administration, no politician could really stray from supporting Israel militarily or materially to like actually provide weapons. Sure, the politics would chew it up a bit and then Netanyahu might become enemy number one in certain circles in US politics, but he knew that they would not have the guts to say we're cutting off Israel.
Yeah.
Like I think it was Reagan did that, didn't he? Or was it Jimmy Carter? One of them did that back in the 2000. I think it was Ronald Reagan basically said to his Israeli counterpart, if you don't cut this out, I won't keep supporting you. He knew that wasn't going to happen this year. And so I don't know why Biden continues to pretend that he's upset. Maybe he's doing that for domestic audiences. Maybe the Democrats need their leader to be trying to resolve this, even if
for sure,
if it's futile.
Yeah, there. I think that it's a domestic play. There was a hilarious comedy skit I saw the other day that was like, Republicans are like your uncle who promises a trip to Disneyland, and then you found out actually just went by himself. Democrats, they promise a trip to Disneyland, and then like at the end of the year, and then they're like, oh, actually, sorry, we don't have enough money, and da da da. And I think that, yeah, I think that he has to appeal to a domestic audience. I also had heard that when Biden dropped out of the race, there was analysts who were saying the most lethal months are going to be between now and January, because that's when Netanyahu knows he can get done what he's been doing since last year without significant U.S. pushback. If Harris comes in, if Trump comes in, there's going to be different demands that he might not be able to get past the two of them. So the one of them, whoever is, but.
Yeah. So it's actually interesting you mentioned that, because I think increasingly that there will be a fairly big divergence, depending on who wins in November, in how a lot of these foreign engagements are conducted. I think everyone knows that Trump wants to get the US out of these things. He's going to want some very quick wins that he can attribute to strength, peace through strength. Mm-hmm. And the reality of whatever happens isn't going to matter. It's just going to matter what it looks like. So I think pretty quickly, if Trump is elected, Netanyahu will start saying the right things. I think Netanyahu will start saying, we're at an end. We've achieved our mission. We've brought stability to the region, because he knows that he needs to get on Trump's good side very quickly and to make Trump look good, because reality is Trump's foreign policy in the Middle East is very much to Israel's benefit. He's going to try and resurrect the Abraham Accords. He's going to work with Saudi Arabia to marginalize and isolate Iran, further isolate Iran. Hezbollah will be, it'll be degraded significantly. And I imagine Israel will continue to do things against Hezbollah, but just not in this front page capturing way that they're doing it now. So I actually think that you could see at least a disappearance from the front pages of this conflict, because there will be an interest on both sides to have it look like it's solved, or at least better. If Harris is elected, I don't see what will really change, because again, she is fundamentally wedged just like Biden is. She has to support Israel because that's longstanding American policy. And I don't think that she's the kind of politician, the bold kind of politician, that would say, hey, new sheriff in town, it's time to change. We're not going to support you unless you pull your head in. She's just not that character. We see it the way she's running her election campaign, which is safety first. We see the way she's conducted her political career to this point, which is safety first. Mm-hmm. It would be such a bold move early in her administration, or before she even takes office, to make Israel her thing, to be like, that's the one I'm going to dive into and make a bold call on. I just can't see that happening. So I actually do think that the election could really change how at least we perceive that conflict. It may not actually change the facts on the ground. And I think, not to kind of go on for too long, but you see that the Iranian foreign minister, and I have no idea how to pronounce his last name, but I think it's Arachi.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Thank you so much. Resident linguist, Turkish, German-speaking resident linguist, add Farsi to your list. But he's in Saudi Arabia as we speak, because I think Iran is really worried that they've just had a huge amount of damage done to their proxies. I think they know how vulnerable their economy is to oil exports, and Israel being so unrestrained by the US could well hit their oil exports, their oil ports on the south coast of Iran. So there's this element of like Iran's, I think, panicking that, oh my God, Israel has done a lot of damage to us. We aren't ready for a broader conflict. We need to buy some time. I think that shows you that Israel really holds a lot of the cards here. But long term, Kristen, go back to Biden's quote, tactical versus strategic. I don't see how this actually changes much on the ground in the Middle East over the 5 to 10 year horizon.
Well, okay. And that actually leads us really well into what I want to talk about next, which was Harris has been on a flurry of media interviews, one with The View this week, another with 60 Minutes. And the 60 Minutes one, the one that really raised some eyebrows, was she was asked what she thinks is the biggest security threat to the United States. And she mentioned Iran, which like national security circles very quickly were like, yeah, in this exact imminent moment, perhaps. But really, no, the biggest issue is China, and you're overplaying Iran's capabilities. I mean, what did you make of that, John?
Yeah. So her direct quote, I think, was something along the lines of, it's Iran because Iran has American blood on their hands.
Oh, right.
Because they're attacking they're sending missiles into Iraq and actually attacking U.S. service people, where I think you can make the argument that Russia and China aren't doing that. So I actually think that's quite a smart distinction. Look, I might get in trouble for saying this, but folks in Washington who work at think tanks who work on one issue, China, Russia, they love to like have any opportunity to be like, actually, my thing is the most important thing, and you're an idiot if you don't agree. The question is kind of a perverse one. Like, there is no single thing as your biggest adversary. Like, we're not in the Cold War. It's not quite as simple as that. So the question is simplistic. Her answer isn't wrong. But I also think behind her answer is and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but yeah, quite a clever formulation of Iran. They don't need to impress Iran. There's never going to be a push to improve relations with Iran. Maybe there's a JPCOA Mark II deal, but that will be Iran begging America for it. China, if Harris wins, she'll want to come in and put her own stamp on that relationship. She won't want to have said something stupid in an interview like, China's our biggest adversary. And, you know, the US government and generally Western governments are very careful to kind of calibrate their language on how they see China. Strategic competition, you know, competitor, rival, sometimes adversary, but I don't think she'll want to come in and be like, they're the big target, because it'll make her, it'll make it harder for those first meetings that she has if she's elected. And with Russia, you don't want to big Russia up. You don't want to say Putin's your biggest adversary. Russia is let's not forget, Russia does a great job. Putin does a great job of commanding the headlines. He's brilliant at rattling the nuclear saber, being like, I'm going to bomb you. Russia's economy is cooked. It is a small country economically. I think it's 20th, or it was before the war. It's probably lower than that now in terms of GDP. It is, I'm not going to say it's irrelevant because it's a nuclear power and it's a P5 country, but it is not the country that should be consuming the US's time. So in a way, she picked an answer that I think you can't argue that Iran isn't an adversary. And didn't box her in should she become president. Now, I get that I don't agree with her. I think China is the biggest adversary, but also who cares? Like, if she'd said, I think Germany's our biggest adversary, or I think New Zealand is our biggest adversary, you'd be like, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about. But it was a perfect answer. And I just think Washington is
actually, that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, it's like, sure, it might not really be what her and her team potentially believe or what her advisors are telling her, but it's the best thing to say on 60 Minutes and in an interview, because I don't think there's anyone in the US who believes Iran is a friend.
And right now they are the biggest adversary because they're in a war with Israel, which is a much closer ally than Ukraine. So I think that whole thing was overblown. I did note one other thing from that interview, though. I thought it was interesting that she wouldn't be drawn on NATO membership for Ukraine. She tried to distinguish herself from Trump by saying, you know, Putin would be in Kiev with Trump's blessing if he was the president. I believe in defending Ukraine. But she did stop short of saying they should join NATO. Again, I think I'm building this picture of Kamala Harris. I wasn't super aware of how she was as a politician beyond what everybody kind of knew, but I'm building this picture in my head of her as she is a hyper cautious, don't make a mistake kind of politician. Now, I don't know whether that's the way she's running her campaign because she thinks that she can win if she just doesn't screw up, or whether that's just her personality. But I think the answer of we'll cross that bridge when we come to it regarding Ukraine and NATO is just another example of her being like, I don't know, when it comes up, I'll deal with it. It could be that she's a lawyer. Lawyers don't deal in hypotheticals like that, or they'd like to deal with, you know, answers and certainty. So I don't know. But I thought it was interesting that she didn't come out and say, yes, or, you know, something more substantive than we'll see.
Yeah, she's done quite well, I would say, on these different interviews she's done over the past week. First, she was on Call Her Daddy, which I would say went pretty well and targeted the audience she needed to, regardless of what you think about her appearing on a former Barstool podcast for, you know, anyone who thinks, you know,
I think it's a smart media strategy.
It's just totally, it's a totally, totally 1,000%. 60 Minutes. I think the only time where I really clocked that it could have been it was where she was wedged a little bit, but she did pretty well, was on The View when they asked, what would you do differently than Biden? Like, what are you going to say, right? Like, he's still the president.
But you should have an answer for that, Kristen. Like, this is what we were talking about with Waltz last week. It's like, who's prepping you? Like, that is the most obvious question is, like, you're trying to run as a change candidate. You've been vice president. You're friendly with President Biden, although there's some tension there. How will you do things differently? It's a hard question, but, like, get in the war room with your team and come up with an answer that makes you sound, you know, good.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, I think her answer was it was decent. But I do think it's one of those that, like, I think even if you prep for those, it's just it's awkward because you feel wedged personally, just like with Waltz and the China one. It's like he's probably been told 7 different times, you know, okay, we're going to say it exactly this. It is one of those where they probably personally, as candidates, they probably also feel that's their weakest point, and therefore you can see some of the hesitation in the answers.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing too is they're human beings, and this stuff is – I mean, I can't really comprehend the stakes – every time you're opening your mouth in a presidential election. Like, it must be, I feel like you must become sort of a different human being. Like, you just must become someone who doesn't really think like we can kind of comprehend, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You get a tough question. You're like, this could change everything. But speaking of Barstool Sports, I don't think there's much more to say about that 60 Minutes interview. I think the general gist of it. Well, actually, there is one more thing to say. I thought it was very well handled. I thought the moderator, I watched it last night in the replay of it. I thought the moderator did a really good job of asking direct questions while without being kind of antagonistic. So I hope we see her give more interviews like that, because I did think it showed a bit more of how she thinks.
I think it's also interesting. She's gotten a lot of, not to harp on this more because it really is on my last comment, is she got a lot of flack about, you know, not giving enough media interviews. And then she, you know, her campaign seemed to take that on and then booked her for lots of different things.
Yeah. And we'll see if it decreases the media narrative that true,
John,
too.
Tell me about this voting betting market. I want to know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, you mentioned Barstool. So, like, speaking of sports betting, I guess, I had a very interesting conversation with a friend of mine who is a portfolio manager at a hedge fund. He doesn't want me to mention his name just because I think those folks like to operate in the shadows. But he's super, super well connected politically. And I think his hedge fund does a bunch of FX trading and this kind of stuff. So they're no strangers to political kind of bets, as it were. And so we got to talking, and something that's been weighing on my mind is this idea that you can really bet on the outcome of elections, but there's a general sense. So there's this idea that there's a wisdom of the crowds. One person doesn't have access to any kind of, you know, unique insight, but there are these phenomena shown statistically that if you get a bunch of people who are fairly well informed, that if you have enough of them over time, they're pretty good at making predictions. And so what is a great way to make predictions with information? A betting market, because people have to pay money to kind of back their candidate. So you think they're putting time into it. The idea is that random people who don't know anything about it wouldn't be willing to spend their money on it. So you can assume that it's, you know, fairly well-informed folks. So the idea is that betting markets should be a pretty good proxy for the outcome. So, and I said that to him, and he's like, yeah, but not really, because, and you have to bear with me here a little bit. This is where it becomes a foreign policy kind of thing. He said, back in 2016, the Brexit kind of referendum in the UK, that was the emergence of political betting, really. Like, it was around, but that was kind of the first platformized political betting. And the market was really illiquid. It was a small market. It wasn't big because it wasn't popular. And he said, it is absolutely undeniable. No one will ever tell you on the record, but it's absolutely undeniable that hedge funds in London would bet on that Brexit outcome in the knowledge that people would watch the odds change and they other hedge funds would trade foreign currency on it. So the idea that, okay, let's say Brexit was 52-48, stay in the EU, there would be a hedge fund that would say, I reckon we can move those odds with our bet alone because it's a small enough market. So we'll put a couple $100,000 bet on leave. Other hedge funds would see that movement in the betting market and trade FX, and they would take the other side of that trade knowing that they had manipulated the market. So this was the idea behind it. And he said, so it's actually really not a good signal at all. So we come to the US election, and now the markets are much bigger. They're much more robust. I think some of the platforms are kind of trying to prevent that kind of stuff. You know, like sports betting is fairly well adapted to kind of pick people who are trying to manipulate markets. So I don't think you can say the same thing that people are trying to manipulate it and make trades. And also Brexit has a very clear trade. If you believe Brexit's happening, you have a trade that you make to make money. The outcome of a US election, there's not an obvious trade to make, right? We don't know what's going to happen. You can make guesses about stuff, but it's not a clear downstream, okay, bet this.
Right.
But Elon Musk this week came out and on Twitter, after appearing with Donald Trump at the Butler Rally, said, wow, Donald Trump now 51, 52% to 47% over Kamala Harris in the poly market betting. This is where I get a little bit conspiracy theory. Poly market was funded by Peter Thiel. And I wonder, it's not trying to make money. It's not trying to make a bet like an FX trade was in Brexit. But there are very few people who have gone all in on Donald Trump more than Silicon Valley and more than Elon Musk.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's trying to create a narrative, not necessarily one that he's going to make money off directly, but he wants Trump to win. I wonder if he's trying to create a sense in people's minds that Donald Trump is actually winning this thing.
Yeah.
And that would help him for two reasons. One, if he does lose legitimately, there's a much stronger narrative around the election was stolen, and Elon Musk has the power over Twitter.
Right.
So he could propagate that story on Twitter. And secondly, the idea that people like to know what other people are going to do, and it may sway their vote themselves. So anyway, this is a long way of saying, we'd been talking about betting markets before, and I just kind of had a really interesting conversation this week about what's going on with them and whether Elon Musk maybe is putting big bets on the markets to try and influence them, not necessarily to make money off them, but to create narratives around the election.
Create hype. I mean, we've said that this is an election based on hype because it's so there's such slim margins, and that's how Kamala really got a big jump ahead when she first came in. There was so much hype around her, right? There was so much media attention. There was, right? And so if that's just the other flip side of the coin, create hype and where people are going. And if you have some sort of betting market that you can point to that looks like some sort of plausible data.
Yeah, climb on board the Trump train because he's already winning.
Right.
Just don't mention that I've put in, a couple million of my own money to kind of sway the odds. Again, I've no evidence for all that. It was just very enlightening to kind of think that through logically rather than just go, oh, I wonder what the betting markets mean. But anyway, thank you for indulging my conspiracy theory rants, Kristen. I appreciate it.
Well, and you were – well, I was sort of like, what? You know, this is fringe conversation. But then you and Jeremy were on Two-Way this week. Lots of people were phoning in and talking about it. So I don't, you know, it's not an off the wall dialogue and topic.
No, because people have a top layer of understanding about betting markets. And it is that idea that you don't put skin in the game unless you're sure about, unless you have a piece of information that you believe in. So prima facie, they should be reliable. But the second, third, fourth, and fifth iteration of that conversation is there are always people who are smarter and have more money and have bigger motivations who can manipulate those things. And if it's not clear how, but it doesn't mean it's not happening. So I long story short, the election is one of those, predicting the election, and we're going to talk about the polls very briefly to wrap this conversation up, but talking about the election is one of the most consequential events that humans do every 4 years, for better or worse. It just is. Electing an American president is incredibly important to a lot of people around the world, which is why we talk about it. But there is so little data that is reliable on which to predict and prepare.
Yeah.
I think we're all aware now polls are to be taken with a quarry of salt.
Right.
People manipulate them. They're antiquated in the ways they collect polls. So I think we are all aware of their fallibility. So people are scratching around for other signals other than vibes. Mm. Like I've heard smart people say, oh, just go to Ohio and drive and count the lawn signs. Like that is a scientific way to kind of predict an election. So there's all these vibes-based ways of thinking about how you're going to predict an election because the outcome matters and we're humans and we want to know what's going to happen so we can prepare for it. And I think the betting markets are another one of those and they seem scientific and they seem legitimate, but there's probably more going on behind the scenes. But anyway.
For any insight. Speaking of.
Yes, polls. Yes. Well, after saying they're not worth anything, let's talk about them.
Right. Well, they're a piece of data. Data. Why did I say data like that?
I'm winning. I'm influencing you. Come to the data side.
Piece of data. And people are eager to have all the pieces and then pull together. So anyways, the New York Times poll, they are putting Kamala Harris at 49% and Trump at 46%.
This is nationwide, right?
Yep, nationwide. Yeah. Every other state, all the swing states, if you will, they are within an area of a margin except for Wisconsin, which looks up for Harris by 2. I mean, you know, that aligns with sort of what one would think. Oh, and sorry, Arizona up by 2 for Trump.
Yeah. So I like the Real Clear Politics average.
That's
like, you know, it's no better than anything else, except it kind of tries to average a bunch of different polls. And currently it has Trump winning Arizona. And I think most folks think that's still a swing state, but just barely. Nevada, I think most people think, or Nevada, depending on how you're told to say it, people think is moving Harris, which I think is expected. There's a lot of hospitality workers there and the union there is quite powerful. So I think folks think that Nevada will go blue. Wisconsin, I think, is leaning blue and Michigan is leaning blue. And the three, I mean, we've always said from the start, you and I that, I mean, you and I, you, me, and everybody else has always said from the start that Pennsylvania will be the one that swings it. I think I would now add North Carolina to that because those two are like 0.1% and 0.4% for Trump. And the for folks who aren't sort of well versed in the Electoral College math, basically Harris needs to win Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, and one of Pennsylvania and North Carolina or Georgia, I think is the right answer. So she needs to basically, she can lose one Sun Belt. So that's one of Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, and New Mexico, but she's not going to lose Colorado and New Mexico. So it needs to win Nevada, win Michigan and Wisconsin, which she looks like she's on track to do, and then win one of Pennsylvania or North Carolina. And she's just behind in those at the moment, but they're just, again, they're coin flips. Like I don't think I literally place no stock in the fact that she's, Pennsylvania and North Carolina could go either way.
Yeah. And that, I mean, North Carolina also is becoming that sort of last minute. It is a swing. Their governor's Democrat and they have been a swing state in the past, but they've now after the hurricane have become more important. It looks like they've been that October surprise, right? Because there's lots of communities that have been devastated. And if they don't feel like the federal government, which Harris is the VP of, has responded appropriately, that really could, you don't have a lot of time to regain their trust.
No, and just maybe a final note on that before we wrap up. I out of Hurricane Helene, which was what 10 days ago now or something like that, a week ago. I think the federal government has largely been seen. FEMA has largely been seen to be on the ball with that. I haven't heard or seen or read anything that suggests that there's a widespread push to blame the government. So I think they've passed that test, and that's good news for the Harris campaign. Hurricane Milton is bearing down on Florida now. Florida again, and it's not a swing state. Right. And I know it's unpleasant to talk about politics in this context. But again, if there is a disaster in Florida, or when there is a disaster in Florida, and if the government doesn't respond well, and it's going to be difficult because it's going to be responding right on the back of another major hurricane. Mm. So resources are going to be stretched thin. If it screws up big time, then I think it could affect other places than just Florida. People watching it on the national news being like, oh my God, the federal government is incompetent. We need change. Or we need someone like Trump to come in and sort it out. You know, again, it's uncouth to talk about politics at times like this, but these are the things that can swing an election in these late days. And unfortunately for the Harris campaign, there's not a ton you can do about it. It's just, that's the way it goes.
Right. Yeah.
All right, Kristen. Well, let's leave it then. And if anybody is listening to this in Florida, really hope you're safe. I've got friends down there who evacuated. So it looks pretty tough. So all the best to those folks. And Kristen, you and I will be back next week to chat foreign policy and the election.
Thanks so much, John.
Bye.